Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer. I'm your host, Sarah Bueno. I'm a psychotherapist, teacher, consultant, and most importantly, a wounded healer, living and working in Chicago, Illinois.
And I'm your host, Anne Remy. I'm a counseling psychotherapist, yoga teacher, and trauma specialist living in Brighton, UK. On this show, we interview folks in a variety of healing professions, and we discuss the intersectional journey of healing self while caring for others.
But we're not just focused on individual healing, but also healing on the collective level, from white supremacy, late-stage capitalism, and the patriarchy. Thanks for joining us! Anne!
Sarah!
Hello!
Hey!
Good morning here, good evening for you.
Good. Well, good evening to my dog.
Oh, hello!
Sorry. Oh, okay. They're just going to keep going. Sorry.
All right.
Sorry, editors.
Off to a good start already. Well, how are you today?
I'm super great. Since the last time you and I recorded, I have been to Korea and I've been to Taiwan. I got engaged.
Wait a minute. What?
I was waiting to tell you.
How did
we were recording?
What? Oh my God. Congratulations.
Yeah. Holy shit.
This, she did not post this on Facebook, you guys.
No, it's not. We haven't put it on our socials yet because we haven't told all the people we want to tell yet.
So. Oh.
Yay.
Oh.
So we are engaged and that's exciting. And I've been to Paris to celebrate said engagement.
Oh.
He proposed to me on the steps where the Spice Girls filmed their first music video, which is. It's perfect.
I love it. I love it. He knows you.
And I smashed my dissertation. Yay.
We're so proud of you.
Thanks. Yeah. So it's done though. So in the UK, if you're wondering why I am a therapist already, but I haven't finished my dissertation. So the master's program that I'm in is 5 years. And after 3 years, you get qualified, but you're not finished with the program yet. So I guess similar to in the US where you're like, even after you pass your master's, you get your, fellowship or something like that. So essentially I'm just finishing the 2 years. Although when I register in the United States, it's looking like I may have to do another 2 years.
Start all over again.
I'll be qualified as hell by the time I finish.
Right. Well, yes. Congratulations. Yay. Oh my goodness. Well, now I want to ask you all kinds of personal questions about the wedding and all that, but we'll have to do that later.
That's great because I don't have any answers for you. No answers.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, speaking of answers, I'm not as good at segues as you are, but
good.
It wasn't good at all. There's no good way, but I'm segueing into, if you want to support us, if you want to support Anne as she is venturing into marriagehood, you can support us in the following ways. I don't think marriagehood is, that's not a word. You can go to patreon.com/convos with a wounded healer. You can give us any amount of money that you would like is very nice. A lovely donation. Anne's mom is now a Patreon, and we have had a beautiful little email exchange where she has agreed to adopt me as her daughter. So
for just $1 a month, you can adopt a therapist.
For just $1. So yes, so Patreon, you can buy merch on TeePublic. So you go to tinyurl.com/CWH merch. And then you can rate and review us. Go to ratethispodcast.com/woundedhealer and rate and review us. And we will appreciate you for all time.
For all time.
For all time. Speaking of all time, this is actually a good segue.
All right.
One of the all time greatest trauma therapist,
hey.
Janina Fisher, Janina Fisher was my guest for today, and I unfortunately tricked Anne and switched things on her, so she didn't get a chance to listen to it yet, but I have a lot to say about Janina, and I'm really excited for everybody to hear this. I actually got to hang out with Janina, so I, in March, went to the Psychotherapy Networker Conference, where Janina was honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award. and she and I had lunch. I got to buy Janine a hamburger, and it was delightful. And it was really funny. We were walking around together, and you know, people would come up to her and they'd be like, "I'm so sorry to interrupt," and da-da-da-da, you know, and they'd say whatever sweet thing, they'd take a picture. And then I asked Janine, I was like, Does that bug you? Like, how does that feel for you to like be a major celebrity here? I'm like, I'm sure it's weird that like you just walk around your hometown and you know, you don't get that all the time. But when you're at a conference like this, you're a rock star. And she's like, you know, it used to bug me a little bit, but now I kind of like it. So I'm like, go, Janina.
That's so cute. I feel like that's therapist goals, but also like fame goals, where it's not like you can still live your life.
Yes.
But like the people who are in your industry, who respect you yes. for the work that you've done, know who you are and like want to interact with you. Yes. Where it's like, yeah, I feel like that's a nice, happy medium.
Exactly. Yes. Those are my therapist goals. So I told Janine a couple things. I told her about my book that I'm writing, which I've told you all about, Ordinary Trauma Project, which I'm saying it out loud again to kick myself in the ass because I've been really procrastinating on it. And she said she thought it was a good idea. Anyway, and then the other thing I told her about that she also thought was a good idea that I want to tell everybody now because I really want to manifest this. And Anne, when you're in the US, if it happens when you're in the US, you can be on it too. I want a reality show where I'm like Tabitha from Tabitha Salon Takeover, but I do it in therapy practices. What do you think?
Okay, so I don't know enough about group practices to be able to really weigh in on this. But I feel like if anyone is going to do that, you would be great for it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
That is the feedback I desired.
Yeah. I haven't worked with any group practices. Even all my like placements and stuff were really independent.
We'll figure out a way for you to be on the show. Don't worry.
I don't know that reality TV is my calling.
Fine. But anyway, we're going to manifest this for me, Anne.
I'm manifesting it for you.
Yes. And Janina, I'll have Janina on as a special guest since I told her. And it was so cute. I mean, I don't know who watched Tabitha Salon Takeover, who watched, you know, Tabitha Coffee. And I don't remember the first reality show she was on, but Janina was like, I love Tabitha. And I'm like, I'm so glad I love Tabitha too. And then we talked about Tabitha Coffee for the rest of lunch, which was adorable.
I met her one time, Tabitha, not Janina, at I used to waitress at this like bougie restaurant in Chicago, and they hosted an event and she was there.
I would have loved it.
When I say I met her, we didn't exactly have a chat because I was a waitress at the time. So I was like passing hors d'oeuvres.
Right.
But there she was. And I didn't know it was her. I saw someone from behind and I was like, wow, her hair looks amazing. And then I saw her from the front and I was like, ah.
And you're like, pig in a blanket, madam?
Yeah. May I offer you an hors d'oeuvre?
Oh my.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we can both be starstruck for Tabitha Coffee and Janina Fisher. So if you have not heard of Janina Fisher, go look her up immediately, but I'll tell you her very short bio. Janina Fisher, PhD, is a licensed clinical psychologist and international expert on the treatment of trauma. She's the author of Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors, Overcoming Self-Alienation, Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma, a workbook for survivors and therapists, and the Living Legacy Instructional Flipchart. She's best known for her work on integrating mindfulness-based and somatic interventions into trauma treatment. So please enjoy this wonderful, heartwarming conversation with Janina Fisher.
Yay!
Hey there, therapist. How you doing? If you're like a lot of people out there, maybe you need a little bit more support than usual. Well, I've got you covered. I'm currently running two groups that I plan to run again in the fall of 2024. So add your name to the waitlist to be notified as soon as info is available. First is the Burnt Out Practice Owner Support Group for group therapy practice owners. We'll focus on the emotional component of business ownership while building trust and connection with other practice owners. We'll explore topics such as boundary setting, feeling underappreciated, overwork, and find ways to reconnect with our agency. And you'll also have the support of other practice owners when challenges arise within your business. Next is the Authentic Leaders Group. It's here to help you become the authentic and wholehearted leader you aspire to be. Join me on an 8-month journey of self-discovery and leadership mastery, where you'll enhance your leadership skills and forge meaningful connections with fellow therapists who are committed to their own growth and the betterment of the therapy field. For the Burnt Out Practice Owner waitlist, go to www.headheartbiztherapy.com/burntout. Make sure you've got the T in B-U-R-N-T-O-U-T. And next is the Authentic Leaders Group waitlist at www.headheartbiztherapy.com/authentic-leaders-group. Hope to see you soon. Hello, Janina Fisher. Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh my gosh. I'm so delighted. And I forgot to tell you before we started recording, I'm going to be at Psychotherapy Networker. So I'm definitely going to be stalking you and hope to hang out with you a little bit while we're there too.
Great. I love my stalkers.
Yeah, I'm the weird one. I'm one of the good ones, right? We'll see.
Absolutely.
I might be fangirling a little bit, so please excuse me, but I'm sure a lot of listeners already know who you are, but would you like to introduce yourself the way that you like to do so?
Yes. I mean, I think for those of you who don't know me, I have been in the trauma field since 1990-ish. So I've been on this very long journey of a generation that was trying to, first of all, educate the mental health world that besides war, it was also traumatic to have had abuse and neglect as a child. It was also traumatic to be the victim of domestic violence. Things that experts knew were unpleasant, but they couldn't understand that life events can be traumatic and life events can be painful and distressing and leave scars, that both can be true.
Absolutely.
So it's been a really very meaningful journey because I was drawn to this idea, which was revolutionary in 1990, not anymore, that people suffer not because of their biology, not because of their infantile fantasies. They suffer because real things happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, to me, that was like the sanest thing I had ever heard in the mental health world.
Yeah. Yeah. I really want to dig into that. But first, I would love to hear your therapist origin story. Like, why did you go into the field to begin with?
Well, I've always said, you know, I was a junior therapist as a young kid. What I've since discovered, and I didn't discover it until my father was 85, and I'd already been in the trauma field for many years. And sometimes I would ask myself, what is it that's drawing me so strongly to this field?
Hmm.
Because I'm not a trauma survivor. But something was always drawing me. And so when he was 85, my father revealed to me that he was traumatized as a child.
Mm.
And then almost as an afterthought, at the end of hearing his very, very painful childhood story, he said, kind of as a throwaway, he said, so you can imagine, no wonder your mother and I couldn't remain married, because she, of course, was a victim of sexual abuse. And my mother was had died 10 years before. Mm. So I never had a chance to talk to her about it. But it was like, oh my God, this explains everything about my parents. So I was what I call a junior therapist, very young, not because there was anything overtly happening. My mother was sort of depressed and I now think dissociated. She was in her own little world and kind of oblivious to us as children. And my father traveled a lot, very warm and very loving when he was there. But I've discovered over the years, he was a person who could only tolerate family life for a couple of days.
Mm.
And then he would shut down.
Mm.
And so as a little kid, I knew there were secrets, and I would make a huge fuss until my mother came out of her little dissociation bubble and would actually engage. And I was like a little detective. Terrible, not good therapist behavior. At one point, when I was 13, I started steaming open my mother's mail to see if I could find out the secret.
Wow.
And so one day, I steamed open a letter from my father's mother to my mother that said, "Dear Joan, I am so very sorry to hear that you want to end your marriage to my son."
Wow.
And I'm like, holy shit, this is the secret.
Wow.
And so.
And you were 13.
I was 13. I sealed the letter back up and put it in the pile. And I decided that I was going to save it for some special occasion. I hadn't quite decided what the occasion was. But of course, it turned out to be someday, like a few months later, my mother said, "You have to be home at 10 or something that felt totally unreasonable to me. And I'm like, "I know your secret." But I felt, you know, in retrospect, I thought, you know, I was doing kind of confrontational family therapy.
Yeah.
I now have empathy for my mother. I think she was so depressed and traumatized that I probably overwhelmed her as a kid. And I'm very lucky that she wasn't violent.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing both of my parents did right that was really important is it was very open conversation that my mother went to therapy every week.
Wow. That's extraordinary for that their age, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was like 100 years ago. I mean, they were born 100 years ago.
Yeah.
and my father, a little later on in my late teenage years, he disclosed that he was an alcoholic and got sober. And thereafter, so starting when I was probably 17, 18, he was always talking about recovery and how important it was. And I remember him talking about, you know, sobriety is just the beginning of recovery.
Oh, yeah.
And so I felt like both of my parents were communicating that growing and developing and healing our wounds is the life's work of any adult. And I'm so grateful when I think back to how wounded they were and how they were able to communicate that without revealing much of their woundedness, but they were able to communicate that therapy and personal change are an inherent part of being a smart grown-up.
Yeah. So let me preface this by saying, I'm not trying to tell you were traumatized because that is not my bag. But hearing this story, if you were my client and you told me those things, I would code those as trauma, having a dissociative mother, potentially going through a divorce, like being a child, knowing that there are secrets. So what do you think, what was the, I guess, like the resilience or the support that helped you move through it without being traumatized by those potentially traumatizing circumstances?
I mean, I think really to me, and this gets to the heart of kind of my history in the trauma world, the difference between what their behavior was is they weren't frightening. I never felt unsafe.
Ooh.
I felt hurt. I felt unimportant. I felt angry, but I never felt unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is amazing because my father had a temper. But he was so warm and loving and then occasionally he would blow up. So I didn't even feel afraid of him when he got mad. Because my father, in my mind, was a big teddy bear.
That's so, yeah, you just kind of blew my mind. Because one of the things the listeners know, I'm working on a book about my own trauma history and calling it ordinary trauma because, you know, if I tell my story, a lot of people wouldn't hear trauma in it, but I felt afraid. I felt afraid.
Exactly.
And you're making it so simple for what's trauma and what's not trauma. Thank you.
Yes. And, you know, I feel like, you know, by the skin of my teeth, and I guess I have to give credit to my parents. As wounded as they were, they managed to create a safe enough environment.
Yeah, safe enough, right? Like that's all it is. Because I know every time we start talking about trauma, anybody who has children who's listening is panicking, right? Because they're like, all the ways I fucked up my kids, right?
Right. And I have a younger son who keeps telling me I fucked him up.
Of course.
Even though he's 50, he's 52 years old.
Oh, funny.
He still wants me to know that I fucked it up.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and also I imagine being able to receive that as a parent for the child, right? I imagine that almost every child would want to have that conversation with their parents and have their parent say, what did you say? What do you say back when he says that?
So I say, you know, I'm sorry. I didn't know any better. And, you know, we have a really good relationship. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I think to myself, I don't say it. It's what in my family we call an inside thought. I think, this is what I get for teaching my children to express their emotions. What a terrible mistake.
Oh, funny. But how loving to receive that and be able to say, yeah, you're right. I didn't know any better.
Right.
Mm. Well, let's talk about your entry into the trauma field. And I'm so curious about it, right? Because it feels like basically over the last 10 years when it finally caught fire and people started to really believe in it. So I would love to hear, what was it like at the beginning to sort of pioneer trauma work?
I mean, it's so interesting because, you know, the research shows that something like 40% of people who suffer from depression have trauma histories.
Only 40?
I know. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And research shows similar percentages for anxiety disorders. It's like, and for even for schizophrenia, there's a huge percentage of people with a diagnosis of schizophrenia have histories of trauma. And even now, in the kind of what I'll call the mainstream mental health world, I would say, unfortunately, the majority of mental health professionals don't think trauma.
Right.
Which is mind-boggling, but it was worse back in the 90s.
Mm.
Because in the 90s, how can I put it? You know, something like incest was considered distressing.
And not trauma.
And not trauma.
Oof.
And it really took, you know, it took Judith Herman's work and Christine Courtois' work to actually bring to public attention that sexual abuse existed and that it was traumatic. And then there was an interval in the 90s where sexual abuse was considered traumatic, but physical abuse wasn't. Okay. Beat the crap out of your child. That's not traumatic.
Right.
Lay a sexualized hand on that child. Mm-hmm. It's sexual abuse or sexual trauma. And so then it took us years to convince at least a portion of the mental health world that physical abuse was traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that emotional abuse can also be traumatic, right? If the result is the child grows up feeling unsafe, that's an even newer concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like this uphill battle. So I would be asked to treat or consult to someone diagnosed borderline personality disorder, which of course was the catch-all for all trauma.
Yeah, still is. And that and PTSD, right?
No, now it's also bipolar disorder.
Yes.
And autism spectrum.
Mm.
That all the trauma survivors are now getting diagnosed autism spectrum. And it's like, Really?
I'd love to hear more about that because that's not something I've come across, but it makes a lot of sense given how that's is sort of blown up on TikTok. Now everybody is calling themselves neurodivergent. And right. I truthfully, I don't even really know what that means. You know, and I think that speaks to sort of, you know, how the nomenclature sort of taken over these clinical terms right. and redefined them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is the self-diagnosis diagnosing on TikTok mm-hmm. is scary sometimes. I mean, I think the overlap comes because, you know, trauma makes us sensitive to becoming overwhelmed. It creates big reactivity to traumatic triggers and very little ability to tolerate intense feeling or stress. Mm-hmm. And the same is true on the autism spectrum, right? The, the kind of cardinal mm-hmm. hallmark on the autism spectrum is a really, really narrow tolerance for emotion and stress and difficulty processing whatever is going on. Mm. Also true for trauma survivors, because when they get triggered, prefrontal cortex, the thinking and processing brain, goes offline. So it becomes hard to process information, to even sometimes put it into words. And the same is true in autism spectrum disorders.
Okay, can we pause there for a second? Only because I'm having reactions to this. This is so interesting. So have you seen the show Big Mouth? This is a divergence, but
no.
Okay. So it's really raunchy. So I don't know if it's your kind of thing, but it's my kind of thing. Really raunchy, like cartoon about these teenage kids. One of them is autistic. And in the most recent season, season 4, they have an episode of this kid whose backpack was destroyed. And it's this whole thing, of course, of him like getting a new backpack. And they take you through his mental process. And yeah, it's really interesting. And what was super interesting to me is, so I call them quote unquote weird food things, and it's a rigidity around food because I'm a super taster. I also have an inkling that it might have had to do with some sexual abuse. And the way that the kid responded in this cartoon, I turned to my husband and I said, "That's what happens to me with food." And he was able to understand it. And then I share this with my nutritionist and she said, "Oh, are you neurodivergent or whatever?" And I was like, "I don't know what that means." Well, you know, I don't think so, but that totally makes sense. Yes, because it's the trauma response is the same, different stimulus potentially, but wow.
Right. And it's very hard because trauma survivors can get very rigid around things that are triggering.
Yeah.
And rigidity is a hallmark of autism spectrum disorders.
Right.
So neurodivergence just means your brain is different, you know. The kind of neurodivergence that gets talked about mostly is neurologically based, mm-hmm. not trauma.
Right.
Right. Whether it's ADHD or Asperger's or nonverbal learning disabilities, mm-hmm. it really comes down to, can your brain process? And at least on the positive side for trauma survivors, if your nervous system is at rest, your prefrontal cortex can process information well.
Right.
Right? Piece of cake.
Right.
With neurodivergence, it's a constant that it's hard to process information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That is an excellent differentiation for listeners, too, because I'm guessing that a ton of listeners have been questioning, because I'm sure they're watching TikTok, asking themselves these things. So let me just repeat it, make sure I understand correctly. So a person who has trauma, their prefrontal cortex goes offline in a trigger. But somebody who is neurodivergent, their prefrontal cortex it's always a struggle to get that engaged, to do the executive functioning.
Right.
Okay.
And it was interesting because my older son was just visiting me for a few days to celebrate his birthday. And he has ADD, so he has a neurodivergent brain. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated after I stopped being upset by it. I was fascinated because he couldn't tolerate my disagreeing with him or having a different opinion.
Interesting.
Not like a disagreement, but you know, kind of like, well, my perspective is
right.
He couldn't tolerate it.
Mm.
And he would kind of bark at me and say, "You're not being supportive." And so now I'm thinking, thanks to you, you know, because I was thinking, what an asshole.
I love your honesty so much.
Right. I mean, I love the kid, but really and truly, he is being an asshole. But now I'm starting to think on the basis of this conversation. Mm. Now I think he just can't process holding two points of view in the room.
Yeah.
It's like he's in this rigid mindset. And if I introduce a different point of view, it's probably overwhelming.
Well, and that speaks to, so I most recently trained in NARM. I'm sure you know Larry Heller.
Yes.
And that I feel like has been what has supported my healing. Because Larry talks about being in child consciousness, where basically the prefrontal cortex is offline and you're more in a primitive sort of brain. And then through the process of NARM, being able to like allow compassion to come forward and being able to see choice. And I think that's the way that we're going to evolve out of all of the drama that we have in the world right now, is more people being able to build that capacity to hold two opposites and opposing things at the same time.
Right. Right. Oh, absolutely. We need it desperately.
Yeah. Yeah. And that sort of leads to, I mean, this is a little bit different interview than I normally have, but we don't normally have, you know, pioneers and sages on the podcast. So I'll just ask you, what do you want for the future? It's a big question, but could be anything. What do you want for the future of the profession? Because I think right now we're on the precipice of a really big change in terms of, you know, the expectations around social justice, with AI, with just the way the business of therapy is changing, with venture capital getting involved in it, right? We're on the precipice of everything being different within the next 5 to 10 years. What do you want for us? What do you want to see?
I mean, that's scary.
I know.
That's scary. Because I was thinking smaller, and you just gave me a big,
big
scary picture.
I know I did. Sorry.
It's really all true.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess first of all, I would want the mental health world to actually take in the research that is such a big deal. You know, psychologists and psychiatrists are under such pressure to do research, and it's all kind of all bowed to the research, but nobody actually uses it to improve psychotherapy, unless it's something like MDMA, right? It's like the psychedelic research everybody's excited about. Nobody's excited about the research that says, you know, 40-50% of people diagnosed schizophrenic and treated as though they were, you know, brain injured, actually are trauma survivors, right? So I that's one of the things I want. And I also want the psychedelic treatment world to become organized, because now people are taking their life in their hands, because you don't know, unless you do a lot of research, is this actually an organized treatment plan, or is this just an opportunity for me to pay a lot of money to take a psychedelic without any treatment around it. So I kind of feel like this is like some unregulated, you know, like deregulating the pharmaceutical industry. We're just letting it happen. And, you know, trauma survivors are desperate to try psychedelic treatment. It scares me about what's going to happen there. Certainly, the fact that it's big business, right? Capitalism and psychedelics meet and decide to be friends. It's so scary.
It really is.
It's also worrisome to think about AI as a substitute for psychotherapy. And then I have to think, well, it all depends, I suppose, on the information we give the AI.
Right. Who is the therapist template that AI is going to go off of? Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Is it just saying, I understand. That must have been hard for you. Mm-hmm. Or I'm sort of torn about the whole big business of text therapies, you know, the monthly.
I hate it. We hate it here. So feel free to speak freely.
I can hate it.
Yeah, you can.
Although it's interesting because my older son is a therapist and he just did. He had a client living in another country and having a nervous breakdown in that other country. Mm. And the time difference made it impossible for them to actually have sessions. So my son developed this kind of text therapy arrangement where his client would text him during his waking hours. Mm. Then my son would get the text when he woke up and he would respond. And they used this method to support the client through something like 6 or 8 months, during which my son helped the client get sober, which calmed everything down, and to stabilize his life. And so now the client's back in this country and they're doing a more normal therapy. But it was a godsend.
Yeah. So,
right. And I think about people who can't afford therapy, but maybe they could afford, you know, a half an hour of texting a week.
Mm-hmm. I guess the complicating thing that I hear on the therapist side is the expectations that the companies put on the therapists for their productivity. Because what you said, that's great. Yeah. But what's capitalism saying on the other side? Yeah.
Right. Right. If you're the therapist and you're doing it for a big business.
Right. Exactly.
Right. And you're promising the clients that they're going to get services that the therapist would have to stop sleeping in order to deliver.
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah. Can we talk about, so I hear you talk about evidence, and I also have a little bit of, I have a beef with the term evidence-based psychotherapy, only because it, so we're probably in agreement on that. Because I'm curious, I have my own theories about why a lot of these trauma therapies are quote-unquote not evidence-based. I'd love to hear from you your thoughts on that and maybe what you want to see. Like, how do we get trauma therapies to be more quote-unquote evidence-based?
Well, the thing is that the whole evidence base comes from bureaucrats. It doesn't come from mental health professionals. It comes, you know, it started in the UK, was the first country that I can recall who required methods to be evidence-based.
Interesting.
To be used in the National Health Service. I mean, any English therapist can set up a private practice and do whatever they believe in.
Yeah.
But to be treated in the National Health Service, you have to be treated with an evidence-based therapy. That was a bureaucratic thing. Hmm. You know, some set of bureaucrats decided, well, you can't spend money on unproven methods, so you have to have proven methods. And what makes me crazy is that the most widely accepted evidence-based therapy is what's called prolonged exposure treatment, which is so overwhelming that most people drop out. I have a client who went through an exposure treatment. She said it was worse than the trauma. That's how bad it was. And the research is highly flawed. They got their quote-unquote evidence base by excluding from the study, anyone from numerous studies, anyone who had ever had an addiction, had self-harmed, had been suicidal, had a sort of what they call co-occurring diagnoses. Basically, they excluded everyone but the highest functioning, least traumatized individuals. Of that group, of all the ones who didn't have what I'll call more severe symptoms. Of the remaining group, I think an average of 30 to 40% dropped out before the end of the research because they couldn't take it. Mm-hmm. And they used a statistical kind of sleight of hand to be able to include that the ones who left as if they had finished the treatment. So it looks really good.
Janina spilling the tea. Mm-hmm.
Right? You take less traumatized, you know, quote unquote, healthier people, and you count the ones who can't tolerate the treatment as if they could. Mm. And it looks great on paper.
Wow. I don't think a lot of people know this.
Right. So I actually talk about it. I say there are, and I also add, there are risks to evidence-based treatment. It's not like there's no risk to prolonged exposure. There's plenty of risk.
Right.
No, EMDR is the other treatment that really looks good on in the research. EMDR, I think, is a good treatment, but not for everybody. It's overwhelming for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And treatments, like the types of treatments that I prefer, which are somatic therapies, and I have my own trauma treatment method called TIST. Those are hard to research because they're complicated.
Yeah.
And you can't do them the same way for everybody.
Yes. Yep.
Right.
Took the words out of my mouth.
Yep. Yeah. And yet, you know, if I'm a client, I want a treatment that is flexible and works with me, not just a treatment that follows a set of directions in the manual.
Right. Right. And I mean, to CBT's credit, I have a friend who fights with me a lot about CBT, and that's his modality. But at the end of the day, when I had him on the show and we really sort of broke down what we're doing the same thing. Like, he's not doing a manualized version of CBT, so it probably wouldn't be evidence-based anyway, because he's like, you know, kind of going in different directions. And I guess, you know, I have this wish, because I keep going back to how I'm worried about our profession.
Yeah.
I think therapists are in trouble right now. I'm seeing a lot of pain. I'm seeing a lot of lashing out. I'm seeing a lot of people not being able to pay their rent, you know, because things are just, it's a challenge. Mm. And I think back to how do we do better as a profession? And it goes back to our original training in school. And right. I have this great wish that we go back to a training that goes from the inside out. Naropa is the only place I know that does that. I'm sure that there are others, but you know, a general social worker going through their master's program is never going to be encouraged to go to therapy. They're never going to be encouraged to do anything beyond CBT, DBT, ACT, right? Those are the standards we get taught in school. And I don't know, as a person who's like voracious about my own healing, I don't understand why that's not what we lead with.
Right, right. Well, it's like, I don't understand why we don't lead with trauma, since it's associated with every diagnosis that gets treated.
Right.
Right. And then there's the English system, which is mostly working from the inside. And English therapists say, you know, I came away from my training completely overwhelmed and re-traumatized because all we did was therapy sessions with each other. There was no theoretical structure. It was just session after session with each other. So there has to be a balance somewhere.
Right. Well, and it's funny, my co-host, Anne, she's American, but she's getting trained in the UK as a therapist. And she does talk a lot about that inside out process and how challenging it is for some of her colleagues.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. A balance.
Right. Right. We definitely need some of the theoretical structure to make sense. I mean, I think your idea, which is basically therapy should be a requirement for therapists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not, I try in my classes when I teach to have a relational inside-out process in conjunction with the theory, right? I want you to read the book. And then in class, we're going to do what the book says, right? And we're going to use each other because that's how we do it. And not to, you know, not to get too deep, but it's interesting to me it doesn't happen every semester, but often there's one person or two people in the class that find that so threatening. And I know that it's mm-hmm. because they haven't built the capacity to tolerate that. And yet mm-hmm. I'm sad that the academic system sort of prepares people to not even consider that this is an option.
Right. I know, it's funny. I have to say, I rarely meet a therapist who hasn't been in therapy. You must meet a lot of therapists who've never been.
Well, it's not about whether you're in therapy or not. I guess my complaint, and the listeners have heard this before because the podcast has been around, my complaint is I will see people in therapy, but I don't know that I'm seeing them really do their work. I think it's a level of honesty with oneself. That's not what we're holding as, you know, like mm-hmm. to the power differential that's in play between us and clients. We are the same on the inside mm-hmm. and we have to hold that we're in a position of power. And I think that's a really challenging thing to hold.
Absolutely. We have to hold, I'm here because I want to help.
Right.
But I have to also grapple with the fact that I have power over this person I want. Even the wish to be of help mm-hmm. is a little bit of a power over.
Right, right. Well, and when I think about what we're all suffering through right now, right, the chaos and the state of the world, mm-hmm. therapists are experiencing it just the same as clients.
Right.
You know, during COVID, I feel like that was sort of the real awakening to it's always been true. But that was the first time we were having this collective crisis where, oh shit, every single one of us is going through the same thing. And I'm sitting with my clients just as scared as they are, you know,
right.
And that piece, and I have power, and we have this sort of contract that I am supposed to help you. And mm-hmm. I don't know that I see the majority of therapists holding that as sacredly as I want them to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I never had any problem sharing my fear with clients. I mean, not unregulated fear. I mean, I'm sure they didn't know how freaked out I was. But if they said, I'm afraid, I said, I know what you exactly how you feel. Yeah, it's very, very tricky. I mean, it's getting trickier by the moment.
Right.
Given the divisions in our country.
Right.
And in the world. It's funny, I used to always talk in my presentations, I would reference whatever was going on in the world, which just abruptly stopped because it doesn't feel safe.
The list is too long too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Good point. Yes. The list is very, very wrong. And of course, you know, Bessel van der Kolk has always talked very openly about his political view. And clients have been totally freaked out by it. Because they don't want to hear his liberal political views when they have very conservative views.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We need more therapists. We need them to make enough money to take care of themselves, mm-hmm. including mm-hmm. nurture themselves, but we need them to be better at what they do.
Right.
And that's very hard.
Right.
It's fair, you know, in the UK, therapists are required to have supervision for their entire lives.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Every therapist in the UK has a supervisor. And if they can't find someone who knows what they do, they have to find a supervisor who's more of a generalist.
Wow.
Because it's an absolute requirement.
I love that.
I do too.
Because when I think about why systems of power become unchecked, it's because of no accountability. And in our profession, there's not, we have boards, but when I think of some of the questionable things, I mean, Janina, if I could get you in on these therapist Facebook groups in Chicago, holy shit, your mind would be blown. This is a lot of what I'm reacting to right now as I'm seeing the wave of unhinged, it's just the reactions. it's such a challenge. And if I knew those people had a supervisor who was saying like, whoa, let's slow down.
Right.
Let's be with your activation, right? How is this impacting your clients? I would feel better.
Yes. If there was a little oversight, that would be good.
Right. And it's not about control. It's about connection, right? Like I will never stop getting supervision because I know there's always someone who knows something different, right? It's not about more. It's just different, right? And you can see a different side when you're not, you know, sucked into whatever's happening with the client at the time. So I love that. Janina for therapy president. Let's make you therapist president.
I accept the nomination.
Great. Who's voting? We'll begin. My dogs are voting very loudly downstairs.
Thank you for the nomination.
I love it. I will. We'll get you elected in no time, I'm sure.
That would be wild.
Yeah. Well, I see we're coming to the end of the hour. And I mean, selfishly, I would really love to just be able to talk to you anytime. I didn't even ask the normal questions because I don't care. Like, this is just, I really just wanted to hear your wisdom and where you've come and what you see ahead of you. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you really want to leave listeners with?
You know, it's a dilemma. I'm thinking of, I wish I could say something inspiring, but the other dilemma we have is that countries, insurance companies, national health services all require that people somehow heal in a limited number of sessions.
Boom.
So it's very hard for therapists and for clients to work under those time constraints.
Yeah.
I remember an insurance company gave me 50 lifetime sessions for a woman who was suicidally depressed for years.
Cool.
Right?
Yeah.
Translates into about a year and a half of therapy, of weekly therapy.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, really? I had no idea that depression was resolvable in all cases in 50 sessions. Who knew?
Wow. Well, I mean, it just goes back to, you know, capitalism getting involved in what's quote unquote healing. And I'm sure you agree with me that like healing has no timetable. Healing, you know, decides when it's going to happen, right? It's different for every single person.
It takes as long as it takes. I mean, on the positive side, our approaches have become better and better. So it doesn't take as much time as it did 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a quick fix.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Janina, where can people find you? And are you doing your TIST training? I want to take it.
Yeah. Love to have you. It's starting in January. And I have a website, JaninaFisher.com. And I assume, I haven't looked, I assume that there's information about the training on my website. If not, you know where to find me.
I do. Well, I'll make sure to find that so we can put it in the show notes so that others can, find it as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, this was such fun.
Thank you so much, Janina. Again, I have such gratitude for your willingness to spend some time with me today.
Oh, a total pleasure.
Thanks to our guest for an amazing conversation today. To find out more about today's guest, you can visit www.headheartbiztherapy.com/podcast.
You can find Sarah at Head Heart Biz Therapy on Facebook and Instagram.
And you can find Anne at Spare Room Wellness or spareroomwellness.com.
Thanks as always to Andrea Klunder and the Creative Imposter Studios for editing, to Liam O'Donnell for the album art, and to Ben Mueller for our theme music. Until next time, bye-bye.